Chapter 48. Berlin. For Hermann Göring, the losses in Sunday's air battle were shocking and humiliating. His commanders knew soon afterward the true extent of their losses by the number of aircraft that failed to return. Even though far short of the 183 victories claimed by the RAF, the number of downed German planes was hard to fathom. 60 aircraft, 34 of which were bombers. The loss was even more grave than this, however, for the tally did not reflect the fact that another 20 bombers had been badly damaged, and that many members of the returning crews had been pulled from their planes dead, maimed, or otherwise wounded. The RAF, by final count, had lost only 26 fighters. Up to this point, Göring had promoted the idea that his bomber crews were more courageous than their British counterparts because they attacked in broad daylight as well as at night, unlike the cowardly British, who conducted their raids against Germany only under cover of darkness. But now he halted all major daylight attacks, though later that week there would be one more large and, for the Luftwaffe, extremely costly daytime raid against London. "We lost our nerve," said Field Marshal Erhard Milch in a later interrogation. Milch, described by British intelligence in August 1940 as a vulgar little man who revered medieval gods and ceremonies, had been instrumental in helping Göring build the Luftwaffe. The losses were unnecessary, Milch said. He cited two main causes. A. The bombers flew in a frightful formation. B. The fighter escort was never where it should have been. It wasn't disciplined flying. The fighters, he said, didn't stick to fighter escort work. They were more for freelance fighter activity, as they wanted to shoot aircraft down. That the Luftwaffe had failed was clear to all, especially to Göring's patron and master, Adolf Hitler. Propaganda chief Goebbels, meanwhile, wrestled with yet another propaganda challenge: how to cool the outcry caused by the Luftwaffe's bombing of Buckingham Palace the preceding Friday, which was proving to be a public relations debacle. In war, inhumane things happened every day, but to the world at large, the attack seemed mean-spirited and gratuitous. What would help blunt the outrage, Goebbels knew, would be a revelation that the palace had itself become a storage depot for munitions, or that a significant warehouse, or power station, or other target was located near enough to make it seem plausible that the palace had been hit by stray bombs. Even though the nature of the attack, with a bomber diving through rain and clouds and flying along Whitehall toward one of the largest, most recognizable landmarks in London, made this defense seem singularly feeble. At his Sunday propaganda meeting, Goebbels turned to Major Rudolf Wodarg, the Luftwaffe's liaison to his ministry, and directed him to ascertain whether there are any military targets in the vicinity of Buckingham Palace. If not, Goebbels said, German propaganda must make them up, specifically by asserting that secret military stores are concealed in its immediate neighborhood. Chapter 49. Fear. Mary's first week with the Women's Voluntary Service brought home to her the real impact of the war. The country mouse found herself assigned to help find places to live for families who had been bombed out of their London homes or were fleeing the city out of fear that this fate would befall them. They arrived in a flood, bringing terrifying tales of their experiences in London. The number of refugees far outstripped the available billets, which caused the WVS to politely but firmly appeal to citizens in the area to open their homes to the newcomers. Special emergency laws, passed when the war began, gave the government the power to commandeer homes, but the WVS was reluctant to invoke it for fear of generating resentment and exacerbating already simmering class hostility. Dock worker meets country gentleman at a time when there was plenty of tension to go around. For Mary, the contrast between what she now encountered and how she had spent her summer at Breckles Hall was almost incomprehensible. Just 2 weeks earlier, she and Judy Montagu had been bicycling happily through the countryside, bathing in the estate's pond and dancing and flirting with young officers of the RAF. The war, distant and out of frame. Even the guns at night were more a source of comfort than terror. But now, this is the 20th century. Mary wrote in her diary that weekend, "Look on London. Look at the crowds of homeless destitutes and weary people in Aylesbury alone. I have seen more suffering and poverty this week than ever before. I cannot find words to describe my feelings about it. I only know I am moved to a greater and wider realization of the suffering war brings. I only know that I have learned more about human suffering and anxiety than ever before. O God, be with the homeless and anxious. I have seen so many worried and sad and lost expressions, and a great deal of courage and optimism and good sense. 2 days later, on Monday, September 23rd, Mary read the news about the sinking of the city of Benares and the deaths of so many of the children aboard. May God rest their souls, she wrote in her diary that night, and help us to wipe the curse of Hitler and the vilest burden mankind has ever borne from the world. Her father ordered that, in view of the sinking, the further evacuation overseas of children must cease. In the distance, guns fired and shells burst, but in the prison room at Chequers there was peace and history and the benign presence of Lady Mary's ghost. No matter how harsh the stories Mary heard each day, she was able to retreat each night to her lovely home, to be looked after by Monty, Grace Lamont, the Chequers housekeeper, and kept company by Pamela, as the latter awaited the arrival of her baby. Unexpectedly, Pamela's doctor, Carnac Rivett, also now made himself a more or less full-time inhabitant, much to Clementine's displeasure. She found his presence both oppressive and embarrassing, especially since Chequers was not the Churchills' private property, but belonged to the government. She told Pamela, "My darling, you must realize this is an official house, and it is rather awkward having the doctor every night at the dinner table." Rivett often stayed the night, arguing that his presence was required because the baby could come at any time. Pamela suspected that Rivett was driven by a different motive, fear. He was, she believed, terrified of the bombing in London and came to Chequers to be safe. Her baby was due in 3 weeks. John Colville left Chequers Sunday afternoon after tea and travelled to London to have dinner at his family's home in Eccleston Square, near Victoria Station. Just before they sat down to eat, the sirens rang out, and soon came the sound of German bombers overhead. Colville went up to a bedroom. With the lights off behind him, he knelt by a window to watch the raid unfold. It was all very surreal, bombs falling into the heart of one's capital city, one's home. But it also had a certain beauty, which he attempted to describe in his diary before going to bed. "The night," he wrote, "was cloudless and starry, with the moon rising over Westminster. Nothing could have been more beautiful, and the searchlights, interlaced at certain points on the horizon, the star-like flashes in the sky where shells were bursting, the light of distant fires, all added to the scene. It was magnificent and terrible. The spasmodic drone of enemy aircraft overhead, the thunder of gunfire, sometimes close, sometimes in the distance, the illumination like that of electric trains in peacetime as the guns fired, and the myriad stars, real and artificial, in the firmament. Never was there such a contrast of natural splendour and human vileness." Chapter 50. Hess. The letter was a curious one. England's network of censors kept close watch on all mail entering and leaving the country, and this letter, mailed from Germany on September 23rd, immediately drew their attention. The outer envelope was addressed to an elderly British woman, a Mrs. V. Roberts, but it contained a second envelope and instructions to send that one to a prominent Scotsman, the Duke of Hamilton. Inside this second envelope, the censors found a letter that seemed disconcertingly cryptic, proposing a meeting in a neutral city, perhaps Lisbon. The letter was signed only with the initial A. The censors gave the letters to Britain's domestic counterintelligence agency, MI5, and there they remained. The Duke would not learn of their existence until the following spring, 6 months after they were posted. Chapter 51. Sanctuary. Germany's assault on London grew in intensity, as Göring sought to dispel the taint of failure that had gathered around him like a fog, dulling the gleam of his white uniforms and glinting medals. Every night, scores of bombers advanced on London in waves, Bombing was abandoned, though officially Germany still clung to its claim that the Luftwaffe was only going after targets of military significance. In practice, however, it waged war more openly against the city's civilian population than ever before. For one thing, the Luftwaffe was deploying increasing numbers of bombs known as parachute mines, which drifted wherever the wind carried them. Loaded with 1,500 pounds of high explosives, they could destroy everything and everyone within a 500-yard radius. Originally designed to destroy ships, they were first used over land on September 16th, when 25 were dropped on London, descending on the city in eerie silence. The terror they raised was amplified when 17 of them failed to explode, forcing evacuations of whole neighborhoods until the weapons could be disarmed by specially trained technicians from the Royal Navy. The mines soon began falling in increasing numbers. In a note to Pug Ismay on September 19th, a day when the Luftwaffe set loose 36 such weapons, Churchill wrote that dropping mines by parachute proclaims the enemy's entire abandonment of all pretense of aiming at military objectives. He proposed to retaliate by dropping similar weapons on German cities, matching one for one. With ruthless glee, he also suggested publishing in advance a list of the German cities to be targeted, to build foreboding. "I do not think they would like it," he wrote, "and there is no reason why they should not have a period of suspense." With the German shift to night raids, life in London became compressed into the hours of daylight, which, as autumn advanced, began to shrink with a dreadful ineluctability, all the faster because of the city's northern latitude. The raids generated a paradox. The odds that any one person would die on any one night were slim, but the odds that someone, somewhere in London, would die were 100%. Safety was a product of luck alone. One young boy, asked what he wanted to be when he grew up, a fireman or pilot or such, answered, "Alive." Scores of residents did die, and the onset of night became a source of dread. But by day, life took on a strange normalcy. The shops of Piccadilly and Oxford Street still teemed with customers, and Hyde Park still filled with sunbathers, more or less confident that German bombers would not pass overhead until after dusk. A pianist, Myra Hess, held daily concerts in the National Gallery on Trafalgar Square during lunch hour to avoid the nightly rains. The hall filled to capacity, many attendees sitting on the floor, gas masks at hand just in case. "Audiences edged toward tears, the applause tremendous and moving," observed Molly Panter Downs, the New Yorker writer. From time to time, the pianist showed off her dexterity by playing music with an orange under each hand. Afterward, everyone hurried away, Panter Downs wrote, shouldering their gas masks and looking all the better for having been lifted for an hour to a plane where boredom and fear seem irrelevant. Even night came to seem less intimidating, despite the escalating violence and spreading destruction. At one point, mass observation diarist Olivia Cockett and a friend, Peg, went for a stroll during an air raid. "Walked out into the light of the full moon," Cockett wrote. "We're so thrilled with its beauty, we walked to Brixton, through gunfire and all, admiring the effects of shadow and light, and liking the empty quiet of the streets. As Peg said, the war and the guns did seem trivial, essentially frivolous, against that solemn splendour." Another diarist, also a young woman, described her own surprise at how she felt while lying in bed after a near miss by a bomb. "I lay there feeling indescribably happy and triumphant," she wrote. "I've been bombed," I kept saying to myself over and over again, trying the phrase on like a new dress to see how it fitted. "I've been bombed. I've been bombed. Me." Many people had probably been killed or wounded during the raid, she acknowledged, "but never in my whole life have I ever experienced such pure and flawless happiness." Diarist Phyllis Warner found that she and fellow Londoners were surprised by their own resilience. "Finding we can take it is a great relief to most of us," she wrote on September 22nd. "I think that each one of us was secretly afraid that he wouldn't be able to, that he would rush, shrieking to shelter, that his nerve would give, that he would in some way collapse, so that this has been a pleasant surprise." But the persistence of the raids and the increasing destruction also had a darker effect. Wrote novelist Rose Macaulay on Monday, September 23rd, "I am getting a burying phobia. result of having seen so many houses and blocks of flats reduced to piles of ruins from which people can't be extracted in time to live, and feel I would rather sleep in the street. But no, I mustn't do this. Harold Nicholson had a similar fear, which he confided to his diary the next day. "What I dread," he wrote, "is being buried under huge piles of masonry and hearing the water drip slowly, smelling the gas creeping towards me, and hearing the faint cries of colleagues condemned to a slow and ungainly death." Many Londoners began complaining of gastrointestinal distress, a condition called siren stomach. Rationing remained an irritant, especially the total absence of eggs in stores, but here too one could adapt. Families raised hens in their yards, a tactic adopted by the prof, who kept chickens at his laboratory and in the Christchurch meadow at Oxford. A Gallup poll found that 33% of the public had begun growing their own food or raising livestock. The Churchills were subject to rationing rules, but managed to live well all the same, thanks in part to the generosity of others. Churchill seemed to attract charitable offerings by friends. In 1932, upon returning to London after a lecture tour, during which he was struck by a car in New York and hospitalised, he was given a new Daimler automobile, paid for by donations from 140 contributors, including Lord Beaverbrook. The prof, being a vegetarian, did not consume his allotted rations of meat and bacon, and ceded these to the Churchills for their use. At Chequers, food was always a welcome hostess gift. The king sent venison, pheasants, partridges and hares from the royal hunting grounds at Balmoral Castle in Scotland and Sandringham in Norfolk. The provincial government of Quebec sent chocolate. The Duke of Westminster sent salmon via fast train marked "Deliver immediately." Churchill was, of course, the Prime Minister, and with this came a degree of privilege denied the common man, as in the case of that most precious of commodities, gasoline. The Ford automobile kept at Chequers, license plate DXN609, consumed gasoline at a rate higher than Churchill's allocation of 80 gallons, which was supposed to have lasted from June 1st through July. By late June, it became apparent that a good deal more fuel was necessary. An ordinary Londoner would have been out of luck. All Churchill had to do was ask for more. "If you would also be careful to star your letter, it will receive my immediate personal attention," wrote Harry B. Herman Hodge, a divisional petroleum officer for the Mines Department, which oversaw gasoline rationing. The necessary coupons were issued to caretaker Grace Lamont, Monty, for another 58 gallons. When Churchill realised early on that his allotted food rations could not possibly feed the many official guests he now entertained, he simply requested extra coupons. On June 30th, Private Secretary John Martin wrote to the Ministry of Food, "Both at Chequers and at No. 10 Downing Street, the rationing restrictions make it very difficult to entertain officially to the extent which the Prime Minister finds necessary." The Ministry agreed to help. "We think that the simplest way to meet the position would be to follow the procedure adopted in the case of foreign ambassadors to whom we have issued special ration books covering meat, butter, sugar, bacon and ham, the coupons being used for official guests entertained by the ambassadors. A set of books is enclosed." Churchill also wanted extra diplomatic coupons for tea and cooking fats. These, too, were supplied. To make sure the foods were available for the coming weekend at Chequers, the Ministry instructed its local food executive officer to notify nearby stores that these unfamiliar coupons might be coming their way. "I hope that the arrangements now made will be satisfactory," wrote the Food Ministry's R.J.P. Harvey, "but if there is any further difficulty, perhaps you will let us know." Happily for Churchill, rationing rules did not apply to certain critical commodities. He found no shortage of Hein brandy, Paul Roger champagne, or Romeo y Julieta cigars, though the money to pay for these was, as usual, never quite sufficient, especially when it came to covering the costs of hosting the many visitors who came to Chequers each weekend. The Chequers Trust, which paid the wages of Chequers staff, and the routine costs of maintaining the estate, donated £15, or just under $1,000 in today's dollars, for each weekend, about half of what Churchill actually spent, or, as he once put it, just about enough to cover the cost of feeding the chauffeurs of his guests. For the period from June through December 1940, His costs at Chequers exceeded the Trust's overall contributions by the equivalent of $20,288. Wine was a significant expense, just as it had been when he was First Lord of the Admiralty. At Chequers now, he spent twice as much. The Government Hospitality Fund agreed to chip in wines and spirits, with the caveat that these were to be served only when entertaining foreign visitors. Churchill took enthusiastic advantage of the programme. One Chequers order consisted of 36 bottles of Amontillado, Duff Gordon's V.O., 36 bottles white wine, Valmour, 1934, Chablis, 36 bottles port, Fonseca, 1912, 36 bottles claret, Chateau Léoville Poitferré, 1929, 24 bottles whisky, fine Highland malt, 12 bottles brandy, Grand Fin Champagne, 1874, 66 years old, same as Churchill, 36 bottles of champagne, Pommerie et Greno, 1926. Paul Roger, however, remained his favourite. The wines were promptly stocked at Chequers by the fund's own government hospitality butler, a Mr. Watson, who noted their exact positions in the cellar's bins. He also complained that the bins were haphazardly marked. Special cards to correct this deficiency were sent forthwith. The fund's administrator, Sir Eric Crankshaw, laid out the precise rules for using the bottles in a letter to Grace Lamont. The wines were to be served only when foreign, dominion, Indian or colonial guests were being entertained. Before each event, the Churchills were to consult with Crankshaw, and I will let you know whether or not government hospitality wines are to be used during the visit. Crankshaw instructed Miss Lamont to keep precise records in a cellar book, provided by the fund, including the names of visitors and the wines consumed. The book would be audited every 6 months. The record-keeping did not stop there, however. After the luncheons or dinners held, Crankshaw wrote, would you please complete a form, specimen of which is attached, to show the nature of the entertainment, the number of guests, and the amount of the various wines consumed, and return the form to me for record and accounting purposes. Many other products, while not rationed, were nonetheless in short supply. A visiting American found that he could buy chocolate cake and a lemon meringue pie at Selfridge's, but cocoa was impossible to find. Shortages made some realms of hygiene more problematic. Women found tampons increasingly difficult to acquire. At least one brand of toilet paper was also in perilously short supply, as the king himself discovered. He managed to sidestep this particular scarcity by arranging shipments direct from the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. With kingly discretion, he wrote to his ambassador, "We are getting short of a certain type of paper which is made in America and is unprocurable here. A packet or two of 500 sheets at intervals would be most acceptable. You will understand this, and its name begins with B." The paper in question was identified by historian Andrew Roberts as Bromo Soft Lavatory Paper. With raids so likely and so predictable, Londoners inclined to use public shelters found themselves following a new and novel routine, leaving their chosen shelter for work in the morning, returning at dusk. Some shelters began publishing their own journals and bulletins, with names like Subway Companion, Station Searchlight, and the Swiss Cottager, this last name for a newly built, deep-leveled tube station, Swiss Cottage, which now served as a shelter. The station, in turn, had been named for a nearby pub, whose exterior evoked a Swiss chalet. "Greetings to our nightly companions," the cottager's inaugural bulletin began. "Our temporary cave dwellers, our sleeping companions, somnambulists, snorers, chatterers, and all who inhabit the Swiss cottage station of the Bakerloo, nightly from dusk to dawn." The editor, shelter resident Dor Silverman, promised to publish only intermittently, at a rate as spasmodic as Hitler's hallucinations, and hoped the publication would have a very short life. Full of cautions and advice, the cottager warned shelterers not to bring camp beds or deck chairs, as these took up too much room, begged all inhabitants to be less generous with their litter, and pledged that soon the shelter would provide hot tea, though how soon could not be determined. "And anyway, while you sit, read, or sleep in quietness and comfort, other things than tea may be brewing up in the streets." In an item entitled, "Are You Nervous?" The cottage's second issue sought to address anxiety caused by the deployment of heavier anti-aircraft guns in the neighbourhood above, noting that subway tunnels tended to amplify noise. Here the bulletin offered a bit of what it called expert advice. Vibration due to heavy gunfire or other causes will be felt much less if you do not lie with your head against the wall. In shelters, the danger posed by poison gas was a particular concern. People were encouraged to wear their gas masks for 30 minutes a day, so that they would grow accustomed to their use. Children took part in gas attack drills. "All the little children of 5 have Mickey Mouse gas masks," wrote Diana Cooper in her diary. "They love putting them on for drill and at once start trying to kiss each other. Then they march into their shelter singing, 'There'll always be an England.'" The raids created a difficult situation for the city's hotels, especially the grand ones, the Ritz, Claridge's, Savoy and Dorchester, which housed all manner of visiting dignitaries, including diplomats, monarchs in exile, and government ministers, many of whom made the hotels their full-time residences. These hotels prided themselves on meeting the whims of their guests, but providing safe shelter from falling bombs and flying shrapnel posed a challenge for which they were at first unprepared. Though here, the Dorchester, situated on Park Lane in Mayfair opposite Hyde Park, had a significant advantage. 9 stories tall, and built of reinforced concrete, it was an anomaly in London. Its opening in 1931 had raised fears that Park Lane might soon come to resemble New York's Fifth Avenue. It was also considered indestructible, and, as a consequence, was particularly popular with senior officials, who closed up their homes and became full-time residents, among them Lord Halifax and Minister of Information Duff Cooper. A previous full-time inhabitant was Somerset Maugham, and during the 1930s, the hotel's nightly cabaret featured a young American entertainer named David Kaminsky, later better known by his screen name, Danny Kaye. Cooper and his wife Diana lived in a suite on the top floor, even though this was considered the only floor in the hotel vulnerable to bombs. It did have a view, however, as Diana recalled in her diary. "From its high windows, one could scan nearly all London beyond the green sea of Hyde Park, sprawled out for slaughter, dense with monuments, landmarks, telltale railway lines and bridges. How red would the flames be, I wonder, when our hour struck?" She could also see the building that housed her husband's ministry. "The high white building," she wrote, "became symbolic to me like Dover's cliffs." The Dorchester's first floor, equivalent to the second floor in a US hotel, was considered especially resistant to bomb damage, given that it was roofed by a massive concrete slab that supported the building above. To absorb blast forces and prevent the intrusion of shrapnel, the Dorchester piled sandbags outside its front entrance so densely that they resembled a giant honeycomb. The hotel turned its expansive Turkish bath into a luxurious shelter, with cubicles reserved for guests staying in the regular rooms upstairs, including Lord Halifax and his wife. In a stroke of marketing elan, the Dorchester published a brochure that touted the new shelter as a prime reason for booking the hotel in the first place. "Experts agree," the brochure proclaimed, "the shelter is absolutely safe against even a direct hit." At least one woman, Phyllis de Jonzay, a friend of Evelyn Waugh's, placed so much trust in the Dorchester that she lived in her own home by day and transferred to the hotel at night. Guests called it the dorm and often appeared there in evening dress. To Cecil Beaton, famed for his eerie nocturnal photographs of bomb-ravaged London, it was reminiscent of a transatlantic crossing in a luxury liner, with all the horrors of enforced jocularity and expensive squalor. Even in the shelter, Halifax fell asleep readily, according to Lady Alexandra Metcalfe, a fellow hotel guest in whom Halifax had a romantic interest. "Edward only takes 3 minutes before he is asleep, but manages to yawn loudly and incessantly as a prelude to dropping off into this bottomless childlike slumber, out of which nothing wakes him." The Coopers occupied an adjacent cubicle and would listen to the various noises the Halifaxes made as they awoke and dressed each morning. "Between 6 and 6:30, we start getting up one by one," Diana Cooper wrote in her diary. "We wait until they have all gone. They each have a flashlight to find their slippers with, and I see their monstrous forms projected caricaturishly on the ceiling magic lantern-wise. Lord Halifax is unmistakable. We never actually meet. At Claridge's and the Ritz, when sirens sounded, guests brought their mattresses and pillows down to the lobby. This made for moments of egalitarian comedy, as journalist Virginia Coles discovered upon finding herself raid-bound in the Ritz lobby. They wandered about, she observed, in all forms of odd attire, beach pyjamas, slacks, siren suits, and some just in ordinary wrappers with their nightdresses trailing on the floor. While crossing the lobby, Coles encountered a member of the royal family of Albania. I tripped over King Zog's sister, who was sleeping peacefully outside the door of the Ritz restaurant. On Wednesday night, September 18th, during a raid that would destroy the famous John Lewis department store, Coles again found herself marooned in a hotel lobby, this time Claridge's, as it rapidly filled with guests, many of whom were dressed for bed. Everyone talked to everyone else. A round of drinks was ordered, and from the general merriment you might have thought an enjoyable, if somewhat odd, costume party was going on. At one point an elderly woman, dressed in a black hat, long black coat, and smoked glasses, descended the stairs, along with three women whom Coles described as ladies-in-waiting. The lobby went quiet. The woman in black was Wilhelmina, exiled Queen of Holland. After she and her retinue passed, the clamour resumed. For one contingent of working-class citizens from the hard-hit East End, the glamour of all this hotel sheltering became too much. On Saturday, September 14th, a group of up to 70 people from Stepney, an impoverished district situated between Whitechapel and Limehouse, marched to the Savoy Hotel on the Strand, a short walk from Trafalgar Square. Here Churchill often had lunch, favouring table number 4, and attended meetings of his other club, a dining society he co-founded in 1911. The club met in the hotel's pinafore room, where a wooden sculpture of a black cat named Casper was always in attendance with a cloth napkin around its neck. The Savoy shelter was by now renowned for its opulence, with sections painted pink, green and blue, with matching bedding and towels, and furnished with comfortable armchairs and the elsewhere forbidden deck chairs. The marchers entered the hotel, occupied the chairs, and vowed not to leave, despite attempts by Scotland Yard to persuade them to go. Wrote Phil Perattin, a communist politician and organiser of the march, "We decided that what was good enough for the Savoy Hotel parasites was reasonably good enough for Stepney workers and their families." With the start of the night's raid, the hotel's managers realised they could not expel the crowd, and instead had the staff feed them bread and butter and, of course, tea. As the nightly raids continued, strange effects and odd moments accumulated. A bomb might demolish one home and leave the one next door unscathed. Similarly, entire blocks remained untouched, as if the war were happening in another country, while other blocks, especially those visited by a parachute mine, were reduced to mounds of brick and lumber. After one raid set London's Natural History Museum on fire, water from firemen's hoses caused seeds in its collection to germinate, among them those from an ancient Persian silk tree, or mimosa, Albizia julibrissin. The seeds were said to be 147 years old. A raid on September 27th damaged the city zoo and set loose a zebra. Residents saw a black-and-white spectre tearing through the streets until the animal was captured in Camden Town. Early in the war, the zoo had killed its poisonous snakes and spiders, anticipating that if their enclosures were destroyed, these creatures would pose a significantly greater hazard than, say, a fugitive koala bear. One air raid warden had a profoundly unsettling experience when, upon crawling into a deep crater to search for bodies, he came across the ruins of what had once been a sculptor's studio. The building had previously housed a variety of marble statues, fragments of which now protruded from the crater. The moon bathed the landscape with a blue-white light that caused the fragments to luminesce. Among the heaps of brick, one would suddenly see a white hand sticking up in the moonlight, or a piece of a trunk, or a face, the warden wrote in his mass observation diary. The effect was uncanny. What the attacks on London seemed clearly to unleash was a new sexuality, as Joan Wyndham's lover, Rupert, had already found. As bombs fell, libidos soared. No one wanted to be alone, wrote Virginia Coles. You heard respectable young ladies saying to their escorts, I'm not going home unless you promise to spend the night. One young American woman, newly arrived in London, marvelled at the vibrance of her social life, despite bombs and fire. Every night next week is booked up already, and the weekend hasn't started, she wrote in a letter home. The only thing people seem scared about here is being lonely. So they date up way ahead of time to insure against an evening alone. Condoms were readily available. Diaphragms too, though the fitting process was problematic. A popular guide to sex was Frank Harris's memoir, My Life and Love's, full of explicit and often innovative erotic endeavours. The book was officially banned in Britain and the United States, which, of course, enhanced its popularity and made it easy to acquire. Everyone was in love with life and living, wrote actress Theodora Rosling, who later, under her married name, Fitzgibbon, would achieve acclaim as a writer of cookbooks. For the young, it was undeniably exciting and stimulating. It was God's gift to naughty girls, for from the moment the sirens went, they were not expected to get home until morning when the all-clear sounded. In fact, they were urged to stay where they were. Young people were reluctant to contemplate death without having shared their bodies with someone else. It was sex at its sweetest, not for money or marriage, but for love of being alive and wanting to give. Affairs involving married women and men became commonplace. The normal barriers to having an affair with somebody were thrown to the winds, wrote William S. Paley, founder of the Columbia Broadcasting System, who spent much of the war in London. If it looked pretty good, you felt good, well, what in the hell was the difference? Sex became a refuge, but that did not guarantee that the sex would be fulfilling. Mass observation diarist Olivia Cockett, in the midst of an affair with a married man, noted in passing that during a week-long bout of lovemaking, she and her lover had sex 6 times, but only one complete for me. There may have been a lot of sex, but lingerie wasn't selling. Maybe it seemed too much of a luxury for wartime, or maybe, in that supercharged sexual milieu, the added oomph of sexy lingerie was perceived as unnecessary. Whatever the cause, demand dwindled. I have never in all my life experienced or thought of experiencing such a terrible season, said the owner of one lingerie shop. We don't have a customer all day, hardly. It's heartbreaking. One man who seemed immune to this sexual conflagration was the prof, who, in keeping with his propensity for making binary decisions that lasted forever, had decided some years earlier that, henceforth, romance was not something he would pursue. He had come close, having fallen for a certain Lady Elizabeth Lindsay. He was 49 at the time, she 27. Twice before, he had been rejected by women, but this friendship seemed to advance in satisfactory fashion until one cruel day in February 1937, when he received news from Lady Elizabeth's father that, while travelling in Italy, she had become ill with pneumonia and died. She was buried in Rome. Apparently that was enough for Lindemann, who deposited romance and marriage into the same vault that housed his many other grudges and grievances. At a party at Blenheim Palace, during a discussion of sex, a woman so notorious for her sexual appetite that she was nicknamed the Bedbug turned to the prof and said, Now come on, prof, tell us when you last slept with a woman. Silence followed. Chapter 52 Berlin. Fighter ace Adolf Galland, still alive and fast accumulating aerial victories, posed a problem for Hermann Göring, chief of the Luftwaffe. Galland's record was, of course, to be celebrated and rewarded, but Göring held firm to his belief that Galland and his fellow fighter pilots had failed him. He blamed them, their inability and unwillingness to provide effective close escort for his bombers, for the grave losses sustained by the Luftwaffe, and for the consequent shift to night bombing, which had brought its own costs in terms of missed targets and scores of accidents and collisions, the incidence of which promised only to increase as winter approached. In the first 3 months of the coming year, accidents would damage or destroy 282 Luftwaffe bombers, nearly 70% of the total loss to all causes. Goering had promised Hitler he would bring England to its knees in 4 days, but even after 4 weeks of nightly attacks on London and raids against a host of other targets, there was still no sign that Churchill was beginning to waver. Goering summoned Gallant to his hunting lodge in East Prussia, the Reichsjägerhof, to air his complaints about the fighter force. Gallant stopped first in Berlin to accept his latest decoration, oak leaves, added to his knight's cross, then flew to East Prussia for his meeting with Goering. At the heavily timbered gate to the compound, Gallant encountered a friend, fellow ace and arch-rival Werner Mölders, making his exit. Mölders had received the same medal as Gallant 3 days earlier in Berlin and was now hurrying back to his base, annoyed at having lost 3 days that otherwise could have been spent in the air, shooting down planes and adding to his tally of victories. Just before setting off, Mölders called out to Gallant, "The fat one promised me he would detain you at least as long as he did me." Gallant continued on to the entrance to the lodge, a large and gloomy structure built of immense logs, roofed with thatch, and set among tall, slender trees. Goering came out to greet him, looking like a character from a Brothers Grimm fable. He wore a silk shirt with butterfly sleeves, a green suede hunting jacket, and high boots. Tucked into his belt was a large hunting knife that resembled a medieval sword. Goering seemed in a good humour. After congratulating Gallant on his new decoration, he told him that he had another honour to confer, a chance to hunt one of the lodge's prized stags. Goering knew these animals the way other men knew their dogs, and had assigned each a name. He told Gallant he would have plenty of time for the hunt, because he had promised Mölders to keep him at the lodge for at least 3 days. Gallant killed his stag the next morning, really a royal beast, the stag of a lifetime. The head, with its great rack of antlers, was removed for Gallant to keep as a trophy. Gallant saw no reason to linger further, but Goering insisted on honouring the promise he had made to Mölders. That afternoon, reports came in about a big raid on London, one of the last conducted in daylight, in which the Luftwaffe suffered major losses. "Goering was shattered," Gallant wrote. "He simply could not explain how the increasingly painful losses of bombers came about." To Gallant, the answer was obvious. What he and fellow pilots had been trying to get their superiors to understand was that the RAF was just as strong as ever, fighting with undiminished spirit in a seemingly endless supply of new aircraft. A week earlier, Goering had announced that the RAF had only 177 fighters left, but this did not tally with what Gallant saw in the air. Somehow the English were managing to produce fighters at a rate that outpaced their losses. With Goering so distracted by the day's misfortune, Gallant again asked permission to return to his unit. This time Goering did not object, despite his promise to Mölders. Gallant left, hauling the hugely antlered stag's head along with him. For part of the journey, he and the head travelled aboard a train, where, Gallant said, "The stag caused more sensation than the oak leaves to my knight's cross." There was big news elsewhere. During Gallant's stay at the lodge, Japan signed the Tripartite Pact to ally itself formally with Germany and Italy. In Berlin, at about this time, a member of a Luftwaffe bomber crew stopped by William Shirer's apartment for a discreet chat. The airman was a confidential source who, at great personal risk, kept Shirer informed about life within the German Air Force. The source told Shirer that he and his fellow crew members felt a high degree of admiration for pilots of the RAF, especially one jaunty pilot who always had a cigarette jutting from the side of his mouth and whom they had vowed to hide and protect if he ever got shot down over German-controlled territory. Night bombing, the airman said, was causing profound stress on the crews. Bombers had to fly on a strict schedule and along carefully choreographed routes to avoid collisions between outbound and inbound aircraft. The crews often flew 4 nights out of 7 and were growing tired, he told Shirer. They were surprised that the raids on London had thus far produced so little visible effect. The airman was impressed by the size of London, Shirer wrote in his diary. He said they've been pounding away on it for 3 weeks, and he is amazed that so much of it is left. He said they were often told, before taking off, that they would find their target by a whole square mile of the city on fire. When they got there, they could find no square mile on fire, only a fire here and there. In another entry, Scheider noted that a joke had begun making its way around the more cynical quarters of Berlin. An airplane carrying Hitler, Göring, and Goebbels crashes. All three are killed. Who is saved? Answer, the German people. As the days passed, propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels grew perplexed. None of it made sense. He could not fathom why Churchill had not yet conceded defeat, given the nightly pounding of London. Reports from Luftwaffe intelligence continued to indicate that the RAF was critically wounded, down to its last 100 or so fighters. Why was London still standing, Churchill still in power? England showed no outward signs of distress or weakness. Far from it. At his propaganda meeting on October 2nd, Goebbels told his lieutenants that an unmistakable wave of optimism and make-believe is at present being spread by London over the whole of Britain and possibly also over the world as a whole. England's apparent resilience was having unexpected and troubling repercussions at home among the German public. With England still fighting, Germans realized that a second winter of war was inevitable. Discontent was growing. In recent days, news that the German government had ordered the mandatory evacuation of children from Berlin had caused a surge in popular anxiety, for it contradicted Goebbels' own reassuring propaganda about the Luftwaffe's prowess at defending Germany against air raids. The evacuations were voluntary, Goebbels insisted at his next meeting, Thursday, October 3rd, and vowed that anyone spreading rumours to the contrary must expect to find himself in a concentration camp. Chapter 53. Target Churchill. With the bombing of London came increased fears for Churchill's safety, a concern that he himself appeared not to share. No raid was too fierce to stop him from climbing to the nearest roof to watch. On one cold night, while watching a raid from the roof of the building that capped the cabinet war rooms, he sat on a chimney to keep warm until an officer came up to ask him politely to move. Smoke was backing up into the rooms below. Churchill, enthralled by gunfire, continued to visit anti-aircraft installations even as German bombers flew overhead. When raids occurred, he dispatched his staff to the shelter below but did not himself follow, returning instead to his desk to continue working. At night, and for naps, he slept in his own bed. When a large unexploded bomb was discovered in St. James's Park, perilously near 10 Downing Street, Churchill stayed put, expressing concern only for those poor little birds, the pelicans and swans in the lake. Even near misses seemed not to ruffle him. John Colville recalled how one night, as they were walking through Whitehall, two bombs came whistling to earth nearby. Colville dove for cover. Churchill continued on, striding along the middle of King Charles Street, his chin stuck out and propelling himself rapidly with his gold-headed walking stick. Churchill's disregard for his own safety drew an exasperated plea from Air Minister Sinclair. "One thing worries me these days, that you stay at Downing Street without a proper shelter." He urged Churchill to take up residence in the cabinet war rooms or in some other well-protected locale. "You are making us ridiculous if you insist on us living in basements and refuse to do it yourself." Churchill's great friend, Violet Bonham Carter, told him that she had urged Clementine to restrain him from venturing into dangerous zones. "It may be fun for you, but it is terrifying for the rest of us. Please realize that for most of us this war is a one-man show, unlike the last, and treat your life like a guarded flame. It does not belong to you alone, but to all of us." Others stepped in to take measures to protect him. Blast shutters were installed over windows to block shrapnel and keep glass from disintegrating into flesh-rending shards. The Ministry of Works began construction of a concrete and steel shield to reinforce the ceiling of the cabinet war rooms. The rising danger also led the government to begin constructing a new blast-proof flat in the building above the war rooms, designed for the Churchills. The apartment became known as the No. 10 Annex, or simply the Annex. As always, the associated hammering drove Churchill wild. He routinely sent his private secretaries to find the source and stop it, thereby causing what Colville believed to be a significant delay in the project's completion. Number 10 Downing, which Churchill once described as rickety, at least had the advantage of being tucked away among larger buildings, within a zone protected by a concentration of anti-aircraft batteries and barrage balloons. His prime ministerial country home, Chequers, was another story. About all that had been done so far to protect the house itself against aerial attack was to install the timbers in the Hawtrey Room. When Chequers' previous owner, Arthur Lee, first saw these arrangements, he was appalled. "When I was at Chequers," he wrote, "I was, I must confess, somewhat flabbergasted by the Office of Works' conception of bomb-proof chambers inside the house, fortified by piles of decaying sandbags against the brickwork outside. The sandbags had since been removed. The timbers remained." Churchill himself was fully prepared to fight it out among the Cromwellian artifacts should German invaders enter the house, and expected his family to do likewise. At one gathering, he said, "If the Germans come, each one of you can take a dead German with you."
"I don't know how to fire a gun," protested daughter-in-law Pamela.
"You could go into the kitchen and get a carving knife."
She had no doubt that he meant it.
"He was in dead earnest," she recalled later, "and I was terrified."
Four helmets, known universally as tin hats, were allotted to Chequers, to be used by caretaker Grace Lamont, Churchill's chauffeur, Clementine and Pamela. Mary had her own helmet and full uniform from the Women's Voluntary Service. It was Private Secretary Eric Seal who first seemed to recognize the vulnerability of Chequers. In a discreet note to Pug Ismay, he aired his fears, and Ismay in turn grew concerned. That the Germans knew the location of the house was beyond doubt. 3 years earlier, Hitler's foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, then ambassador to Britain, had visited the property while Stanley Baldwin was prime minister. With the advent of the air war over England, Ismay realized that Chequers would make a choice target, both for the Luftwaffe and for parachute troops dropped into adjacent fields, though he did not realize just how vulnerable it was until the RAF produced a series of reconnaissance photos of the estate to see how it might appear to German pilots. Taken from an altitude of 10,000 feet, these photographs, and others shot later at 5,000 and 15,000 feet, revealed an aspect of the house and its orientation in the landscape that was thoroughly startling. The long entry road, Victory Way, intersected a U-shaped drive that led to the front and rear entrances of the house. The lanes were surfaced with light-coloured gravel that contrasted sharply with the adjacent greenery. From the air, the effect was uncanny. The long white length of Victory Way looked like an arrow pointing at the house. At night, when the moon caused the pale gravel to luminesce, the effect was even more pronounced, so much so that it seemed a marvel that the Luftwaffe hadn't attacked the house already. Compounding Ismay's worries was the fact that an aerial photograph of Chequers from a private source had already been published in the press and was, as Ismay told the Ministry of Home Security in a letter dated August 29th, therefore likely to be in possession of the Germans. He enclosed a copy of the photograph, in which the house did indeed appear to be a distinctive target, and wrote, "In view of the fact that the Prime Minister goes there most weekends, it is very important that early action should be taken to render it less easily identified." The Ministry's camouflage branch proposed a number of solutions, including paving the lanes with the same material used to surface tennis courts and erecting raised nets, tufted with steel wool, but decided that the best and least costly means of masking the lanes would be to cover them with turf. Clementine wanted this done quickly. Her youngest daughter and pregnant daughter-in-law were now at the house, and increasingly Churchill himself seemed to be the target of the Luftwaffe, as suggested by the apparent rise in aerial attacks on Whitehall. Ismay was concerned about other dangers as well. A security assessment had warned that Chequers required protection against all kinds of threats, ranging from lone assassins in disguise to squads of parachutists. The house and grounds were currently watched over by a platoon of Coldstream Guards, consisting of 4 non-commissioned officers and 30 soldiers. But Ismay wanted this expanded to a company of 150. The guardsmen were housed in tents on the grounds. Ismay recommended a more permanent arrangement, with huts and a mess room hidden in the trees at the back of the estate. Sewage could be a problem, he acknowledged,
Checker's drains would have to be used, and they may be overloaded. In mid-September, as invasion fears intensified, Home Forces stationed a Lanchester armoured car at Checker's for Churchill's use, along with two officers to operate it. The Home Forces General Staff recommended that the officers be armed with Thompson submachine guns. These would provide greater striking power than pistols in the event of opposition from enemy agents or parachute troops. On weekdays, the car would reside in London. Churchill's personal chauffeur was to be offered instruction in how to drive it. The Prof, for his part, was particularly concerned about the dangers posed by the many cigars Churchill received as gifts from citizens and foreign emissaries, not because smoking was yet perceived to be bad, but for fear the sender, or an infiltrator, might lace the cigars with poison. All it would take was a tiny amount inserted into just one cigar out of 50. Only a tested cigar could be ruled absolutely safe, but the testing process inevitably destroyed the sample. One detailed assay uncovered a Cuban cigar that contained a small black and flattened mass of vegetable debris containing much starch and two hairs. This ruled to be the fecal pellet of a mouse. Nicotine itself, MI5's chief tester, Lord Rothschild, pointed out, was a dangerous poison, though he noted, after testing one group of gift cigars, "I should say that it would be safer to smoke the rest than to cross a London street." At one point, Churchill threw caution to the winds. He received an entire chest full of Havana cigars as a gift from the President of Cuba. He showed this to his ministers one night after dinner, before the resumption of a particularly fraught cabinet meeting. "Gentlemen," he said, "I am now going to try an experiment. Maybe it will result in joy. Maybe it will end in grief. I am about to give you each one of these magnificent cigars." He paused. "It may well be that these each contain some deadly poison." Another dramatic beat. "It may well be that within days I shall follow sadly the long line of coffins up the aisle of Westminster Abbey." He paused again, reviled by the populace, as the man who has out-Borgia'd Borgia. He handed out the cigars. The men lit them. All survived. A week later, however, John Colville notified Churchill that he was sending one cigar from each donated box to be tested by MI5. "The Prof," he told Churchill, "hopes that you will not smoke any of the cigars until the result of the analysis is known. He points out that there has just been a roundup of undesirable elements in Cuba, which has shown that a surprisingly large number of Nazi agents and sympathizers exist in that country." Lindemann would have preferred that Churchill not smoke any cigar donated from abroad, as Colville reported in a separate note. "The professor thought, however, that you might like to let them accumulate in a safe and dry place until after the war, when you might feel justified in taking the risk involved in smoking them if you wished to do so." This was the Prof's coolly scientific way of saying that by then, if a cigar killed him, it wouldn't matter. Beaverbrook grew increasingly frustrated with the amount of work lost to air raids, false alerts, and visits by lone bombers, whose mission clearly was simply to trigger sirens and drive workers into shelters. On a single day, two solo aircraft making separate flights over London triggered alerts that caused a six-hour delay in production at the city's factories. In the week ending Saturday, September 28th, raids and warnings reduced by half the working hours at seven major aircraft plants. The cost of these lost hours was compounded by the fact that workers who spent the night in shelters were less efficient the next day. When bombs did strike, the secondary effects were even more profound. Workers stayed home. Night shifts became hard to staff. The risks, however, were real. In July, one company, Parnell Aircraft Limited, a maker of gun turrets, lost 73,000 hours of work to false alarms. 7 months later, more than 50 of the plant's workers were killed in a single daylight raid. Beaverbrook came to loathe the wail of air raid sirens. "The sirens, it must be admitted, became almost an obsession with him," wrote David Farrer, his personal secretary. Beaverbrook deluged Churchill with complaints and hectored him to ban warning sirens altogether. "The decision might cost the country some lives," he wrote, "but if we persist in the warnings, we shall probably pay a higher price in lives through the impairment of our aircraft production."
Beaverbrook laid some of the blame for lost production at the feet of his favourite antagonist, Air Minister Archie Sinclair, accusing him of failing to provide adequate protection for factories and for failing to defend them even after receiving advance warning that a raid was likely to occur. He wanted more barrage balloons hung over factories and more anti-aircraft guns, and went so far as to demand that the Air Ministry assign one Spitfire to protect each complex. He did not believe for a moment that such measures would indeed protect a factory, according to Secretary Farrer. It was the appearance, not the reality of safety, that he was after. His interest was not in saving workers, but in keeping them at their posts, wrote Farrer, adding, he was fully prepared to risk lives in order to produce more aircraft. Beaverbrook also railed against other threats to production, and saw such threats everywhere. When Herbert Morrison, Minister for Home Security and Home Secretary, proposed to allow shopkeepers to work only 5 days a week and to close their stores at 3 p.m. to give them time to get home or to a shelter before the night raids began, Beaverbrook objected, on the grounds that factory workers would then demand to do likewise. This, of course, would be disastrous, he wrote. Beaverbrook warned, too, that if British factory workers did not work their machine tools 24 hours a day, America would notice and would be disinclined to send more tools. That Beaverbrook actually cared about American perceptions is doubtful. He wanted production at all costs. For this he needed Churchill's attention, and raising the spectre of disillusioning Roosevelt was one way to get it. The American claim that we have more machine tools than we require will be completely justified, he wrote. By way of encouraging others to ignore air raid alerts, Beaverbrook resolved to remain at his desk when the sirens rang out. He was, however, terrified. Beaverbrook is a man of nervous temperament, wrote Secretary Farrer. He was thoroughly scared by the noise of a falling bomb, but his sense of urgency prevailed over his fears. The Prof, meanwhile, peppered Churchill with notes and minutes on far-flung topics and novel weapons. His penchant for viewing all things through the icy lens of science caused some of his proposals to veer toward the ruthless. In one memorandum, he recommended poisoning water wells used by Italian troops in the Middle East. He suggested using calcium chloride, extremely convenient since only 1 pound of material should be required for every 5,000 gallons. He was not unaware of the importance of public perception, however, and thus shied from recommending poisons of a more lethal nature, like arsenic, since they raised undesirable associations in the public mind. He expressed no such restraint, however, with regard to simply incinerating columns of enemy soldiers. In my view, burning oil has great possibilities in warfare provided it is used on a large scale, he told Churchill a week later. Flaming oil could be deployed for stopping an advancing force, or, better still, burning up a whole column of troops or vehicles, he wrote. All that need be done is to run a couple of pipes along the side of the road, concealed in a hedge, with holes bored in them pointing towards the road. A pipe is carried away some hundreds of yards to a supply of oil. At the crucial moment, when a column of armoured vehicles is on the road, the oil is turned on and ignited, producing a flaming furnace over the whole prepared length of road. Mary Churchill still resented being tucked away for safekeeping in the countryside by excessively protective parents and not being able to share in the experience of war. On the night of Wednesday, September 25th, she got an opportunity. One of the Luftwaffe's giant parachute mines drifted into Aylesbury and exploded so near the offices of the Women's Voluntary Service as to render them unusable. 19 staff members were injured. The excitement was eclipsed by heartbreak as a tidal surge of criticism broke over her father and his government. Bowing to confident assurances from his top military advisers, Churchill had reinstated Operation Menace, the seizure of Dakar in West Africa by a mixed force of British and Free French soldiers led by General de Gaulle. The attack, which began earlier in the week, at first seemed certain to yield an easy victory. But a combination of factors, including an unexpectedly strong defence by Vichy forces in control of the port, produced only spectacular failure, an operation so confused and inept that it became a parody of the stirring offensive coup Churchill had hoped for. Once again, British forces were compelled to withdraw,
prompting critics to portray the incident as only the most recent of a chain of failures that included Norway, Dunkirk, and, for those who cared to look back further, Gallipoli, during Churchill's initial tenure as First Lord of the Admiralty, when his attempt to land an army on the Turkish peninsula had also ended in evacuation. That debacle, far bloodier than Dakar, had cost him his post. A home intelligence report summed up popular reaction to the Dakar failure. Another victory for evacuation. Mary knew how desperately her father wanted to launch offensive operations against Germany beyond merely bombing the country. Churchill's initial instinct to cancel the operation, after his visit to the RAF operations centre at Uxbridge a week earlier, had been a good one. But he had allowed himself to be overruled by the confident dissent of senior commanders. In her diary, Mary rose to her father's defence. "I don't see how, in the course of having to make endless decisions, one can avoid some mistakes." Within the Churchill household, the failure of Operation Menace was perceived to be sufficiently grave as to pose a threat to Churchill's government. "Oh God, somehow this minor reversal has cast a shadow over everything," Mary wrote. "I do hope the government will pull through. All my feelings are so mixed. Of course I want Papa to pull it off, but not only for personal reasons, but also, if he went, who is to come?" The next day, Friday, September 27th, was no better. "All today seemed overcast with the gloom of the Dakar affair," Mary observed. "It certainly does seem that there was misjudgment somewhere. Oh, I am so anxious for Papa. He loves the French so much, and I know longs for them to do something grand and spectacular. But I fear he will take rather a bump over this." She was shocked by the vitriol from the press. The Daily Mirror, in particular, seemed to have gone mad over the episode. "The Gallipoli touch," Mary wrote, quoting the paper. "Oh, how unkind." On top of it all, compounding the suspense that already pervaded the house, her pregnant sister-in-law Pamela was feeling ill, sick on Thursday, sicker on Friday, and the ministrations of Pamela's doctor, Carnac Rivett, including his apparent obsession with keeping her on her feet and walking, were becoming suffocating, prompting Mary to exclaim in her diary, "Why can't Mr. Rivett let the poor girl alone?" Despite the fact that the baby was due any day, on Tuesday, October 8th, Pamela and Clementine set out from Chequers for London to attend the swearing-in of Pamela's husband, Randolph, as a new member of the House of Commons, a post he would hold while also retaining his commission in the 4th Hussars and continuing as a correspondent for Beaverbrook's Evening Standard. They drove to London knowing full well that the Luftwaffe would likely pound the city again that night, as it had done every night since September 7th, and despite the fact that invasion fears remained high. As Churchill told Roosevelt on Friday, October 4th, "I cannot feel that the invasion danger is past." Referring to Hitler, he wrote, "The gent has taken off his clothes and put on his bathing suit, but the water is getting colder and there is an autumn nip in the air." If Hitler planned to make his move, Churchill knew, he would have to do it soon, before the weather worsened. He told Roosevelt, "We are maintaining the utmost vigilance." Pamela and Clementine carried a tank of laughing gas in the car to administer to Pamela if she happened to go into labour. But it was to Mary, who remained behind at Chequers, that the day would yield the greatest drama. At Chequers that night, Mary found herself the guest of the officers of the Coldstream Guards unit assigned to defend the house. She loved the party and the attention, until the Luftwaffe intervened. The dinner was in full sway when she and the others heard the unmistakable whistle of a falling bomb. They all ducked by instinct and waited what seemed an inordinate amount of time for the detonation. When the explosion came, it was oddly muted. It left the guests rather breathless, but intact and morale on all sides good, Mary wrote. Her hosts rushed her outside into a deep air raid trench whose base was full of mud, which destroyed her beloved suede shoes. Once the raid was judged to have ended, the men escorted her home. "They were all sweet to me," she wrote in her diary, "and I was feeling terribly excited and rather breathless, but thank God, not all white and trembly as I so often feared and imagined I would be." She added, "Damn those bloody Huns for breaking up an enjoyable party." The next day, Wednesday, October 9th, Mary discovered that the bomb had left a huge crater, only 100 yards from the guards' mess, in a muddy field. The mud, she reasoned, probably explained why the explosion had sounded so muted. In her diary, she wrote, "I am not feeling so ignored by the war." Early on Thursday morning, at Chequers, Pamela, attended by the fearful and ever-present Dr. Rivett, gave birth to a son. A young nurse was present as well. Pamela was just coming out of an anaesthetic haze when she heard the nurse say, "I've told you 5 times that it's a boy. Will you please believe me?" Pamela, dazed, needed reassurance. "It can't change now," she said. "No, it can't change now." She was assured that, indeed, the baby's sex would not change. Clementine entered the news in the Chequers visitor's book. October 10th, 4:40 a.m., Winston. This was the first birth in the house in over a century. "Winston Churchill Jr. arrived," Mary wrote in her diary. "Hooray!" She added, "Pam weak, but happy. Baby not at all weak and only partially happy." Pamela's husband, Randolph, newly minted Member of Parliament, missed the birth. He was in London, in bed with the wife of an Austrian tenor, whose monocled image appeared on cigarette trading cards. The next morning in London, Churchill, working from his bed at 10 Downing Street, learned that 2 bombs had fallen on the Horse Guards parade, adjacent to the house, but had failed to detonate. He asked Colville, "Will they do us any damage when they explode?" "I shouldn't think so, sir," Colville said. "Is that just your opinion? Because if so, it's worth nothing," Churchill said. "You have never seen an unexploded bomb go off. Go and ask for an official report." Which reinforced for Colville the folly of offering opinions in Churchill's presence, if one has nothing with which to back them. Churchill met his new grandson that weekend, when he again travelled to Chequers, bringing with him, as always, numerous guests, including Pug Ismay and General Brooke. Churchill was utterly delighted, and he used to come and watch the baby, feed him, and was just thrilled to death with him, Pamela said. While baby Winston was the main attraction, Churchill's attention also was drawn to the crater left by the bomb that had interrupted Mary's dinner party. After lunch, he and Ismay, along with Colville and other guests, gave it a close inspection and debated whether the bomb's proximity to the house was mere accident. Colville judged it a chance event. Churchill and Pug disagreed and posited that it might have been a deliberate attempt to strike the house. "Certainly there is a danger," Colville mused in his diary that night. "In Norway, Poland, and Holland, the Germans showed it was their policy to go all out for the government, and Winston is worth more to them than the whole cabinets of those 3 countries rolled into one." His colleague, Eric Seal, principal secretary, reiterated his own concerns in a private letter to the new chief of the air staff, Charles Portal, who replaced Cyril Newell. "We have established a military guard there which should be adequate for all emergencies likely to arise by land," he wrote, "but I am not at all sure whether he is really safe from bombing attack." Emphasizing that he had said nothing about this as yet to Churchill, Seal added, "I should myself be much happier if it were possible for him to have several other retreats, which could be used irregularly, so that the enemy would never know where he was." Chequers was too valuable an asset for Churchill to abandon entirely, but he agreed that spending every weekend at the house might pose too great a security risk, at least when the sky was clear and the moon was in its fullest phases. He himself had expressed concern about the safety of Chequers. "Probably they don't think I am so foolish as to come here," he said, "but I stand to lose a lot, 3 generations at a swoop." Simply staying in the city, however, was not a consideration. Churchill needed his weekends in the country and believed he knew of a house that was ideally suited to the role of moonlight surrogate. He invited its owner, Ronald Tree, to his office. Tree was a friend of long-standing who had shared Churchill's pre-war concerns about the rise of Hitler. Now he was a Conservative Member of Parliament and Parliamentary Secretary to Minister of Information, Duff Cooper. From a financial standpoint, Tree needed neither post. He had inherited great wealth as a scion of the Marshall Fields Empire in Chicago. His wife, Nancy, was American, a niece of Lady Astor. They owned Ditchley, an 18th-century house in Oxfordshire, about 75 miles from 10 Downing Street. Churchill was direct.
He told Tree that he wished to spend the upcoming weekend at Ditchley, and that he would be arriving with a number of guests, and a full complement of staff and protective guard. Tree was delighted, his wife thrilled. Whether they quite knew what they were in for is open to question. Churchill's descent upon the house had more in common with one of Hitler's blitzkriegs than a tranquil arrival for a weekend in the country. "It is quite a business," wrote Harold Nicholson in his diary, after taking part in one such Ditchley invasion. "First come two detectives who scour the house from garret to cellar. Then arrive valet and maid with much luggage. Then 35 soldiers, plus officers, turn up to guard the great man through the night. Then two stenographers with masses of papers. Next, the guests arrive. The great mass of the house is dark and windowless, and then a chink in the door opens, and we enter suddenly into the warmth of central heating, the blaze of lights, and the amazing beauty of the hall." The decor of the house was by now legendary, and was fast becoming the model for a style of country home decor that emphasized color, comfort, and lack of formality. Its popularity prompted Mrs. Tree to create a home design firm around the concept. Her future business partner would later describe her aesthetic as one of pleasing decay. The Trees did not mind the sudden siege of their home. Far from it. "I have always been one of your greatest, if most humble, admirers," Mrs. Tree wrote to Churchill after his initial visit, "and I meant to tell you how delighted and honoured we all were to have you come to Ditchley. If it is convenient for you at any time to use, no matter how short the notice, it is at your disposal." It was indeed convenient. Churchill came the following weekend as well, and over the next year or so, he would occupy the house on more than a dozen additional weekends, including one of the most momentous of the war. One advantage became immediately apparent to Churchill. Ditchley had a home cinema, which the Prime Minister so enjoyed that in due course, to the dismay of fire inspectors who later deemed it a grave fire risk, he ordered one installed at Chequers. Beaverbrook arranged it, and made sure Churchill received the latest movies and newsreels. "Max knows how to do these things," Churchill said. "I do not." Two projectionists joined the weekly Chequers entourage. Chapter 54. Spendthrift. As if the war weren't trial enough, Pamela's marriage to Randolph grew increasingly strained, as unpaid bills accumulated and his gambling and drinking continued unabated. He dined often at his club, White's, and at various restaurants favoured by London's young and rich, and was always quick to pick up the dinner check, even when his companions were far richer than he. He bought tailor-made shirts and suits. Pamela begged Churchill for help. He agreed to settle the couple's debts, but on the condition that no more bills would accumulate. "Yes," Pamela assured him, "this is the end." Many shops and department stores, however, allowed customers to buy things on credit and billed at three-month intervals or longer, causing a lag between the time of purchase and the arrival of the quarterly invoice. "Then, my God," Pamela said, "there would be more and more bills." The couple's expenses outstripped Randolph's income, even though, by the standards of the day, he made a good deal of money. Between his army salary, lecture fees, the pay he received from Parliament and Beaverbrook's Evening Standard, and other sources of income, he was taking in a robust £30,000 a year, or $120,000, after inflation, incredibly, about $1.92 million today. Beaverbrook alone paid him £1,560 a year, or $6,240, roughly $99,840 today. It wasn't enough, and his creditors were losing patience. One day, during a shopping trip to Harrods, the luxurious department store in London's Knightsbridge district, Pamela was told, to her great humiliation, that her credit had been rescinded. "This," she said, "was horrifying for me." She left the store weeping. Back at 10 Downing Street, she told the story to Clementine, who had no illusions about her own son. His spending had long been a problem. When Randolph was 20 years old, Churchill wrote to urge him to pay off his debts and resolve a conflict with his bank. "Instead of this," Churchill told his son, "you seem to be spending every penny you get, and more, in a most reckless manner, involving yourself in endless worry and possibly in some lamentable incident and humiliation. Randolph's proclivity for insulting others and provoking argument was also a persistent source of conflict. After Churchill found himself the target of a particularly cutting remark, he wrote to Randolph to cancel a planned lunch together, "as I really cannot run the risk of such insults being offered to me, and do not feel I want to see you at the present time." Churchill tended to forgive his son, always ending his letters, even this one, with the closing, "Your loving father." Clementine was not so charitable. Her relationship with Randolph had been marked by outright hostility ever since his childhood, a rift that only grew wider with age. Early in Pamela's marriage, during a difficult period, Clementine gave her some strategic advice for dealing with Randolph. "Leave and just go away for 3 or 4 days. Don't say where you are going. Just leave. Leave a little note that you are gone." Clementine said she had done likewise with Churchill, and added, "It was very effective." Now, hearing about Pamela's ordeal at Harrod's, Clementine was sympathetic. She was wonderfully comforting and wonderfully kind and thoughtful, but she was very nervous also, Pamela said. Clementine harboured a persistent anxiety that one day Randolph would do something to cause grave embarrassment to his father, and this fear, Pamela knew, was more than justified, especially when Randolph drank. "I mean, I came of a family that was really teetotaler," Pamela said. "My father was a teetotaler. My mother maybe had a glass of sherry, and that was it." Life with a drinker proved startling. With alcohol, the already unpleasant aspects of Randolph's personality became amplified. He would provoke arguments with whomever happened to be at hand, be it Pamela, friends, or hosts. Some nights he would leave the table in a fury and stalk away. "I was sort of challenged as to whether to remain or walk out with him, and I found all this very unsettling and unhappy," Pamela said. Soon, she knew, she would have to face the inrush of bills by herself. In October, Randolph transferred from the 4th Hussars to a new commando unit being formed by a member of his club. He expected resistance from the Hussars, but, to his dismay, got none. His fellow officers were only too glad to see him go. As a cousin recalled later, what a shock it was to be told that the other officers disliked him, that they were fed up with his diatribes and could hardly wait for him to get some job elsewhere. Randolph left for Scotland in mid-October to begin his commando training. Pamela did not want to continue living at Chequers alone, on the Churchills' charity, and hoped to find an inexpensive house somewhere, where she and Randolph and Winston Jr. could be a family. Brendan Bracken, Churchill's jack-of-all-tasks, found for her an old rectory house in Hitchin, Hertfordshire, about 30 miles north of London, that she could rent for a mere £52 a year. To further pare costs, she invited Randolph's older sister, Diana, and her children to live there as well, and also recruited her own childhood governess, Nanny Hall, to help with the baby. She wrote to her husband shortly before his departure, "Oh, Randy, everything would be so nice, if only you were with us all the time." She was overjoyed to at last have a home of her own, and could not wait to move in. "Oh, my darling, isn't it rather thrilling, our own family life? No more living in other people's houses." The house needed work, which the war repeatedly disrupted. Her curtain installer disappeared before completing the job. His phone was dead, and Pamela presumed that his London home had been bombed. A carpenter hired to make cupboards got called away for a government job. He promised to find someone else to finish the work, but he had doubts as to whether his successor would even be able to find the necessary wood, a commodity made scarce by the war. The house had 9 bedrooms, and these soon filled. There was Nanny, Diana and her family, a housekeeper, several other employees, and, of course, soon, Pamela and the baby, whom she dubbed variously Baby Dumpling and Baby PM. In addition, Randolph's secretary, Miss Buck, had invited her own neighbours to stay at the rectory after their house was bombed. Miss Buck was very apologetic, but Pamela professed to be delighted. "It is a very good thing from our point of view," she wrote in a letter to Randolph, "as the local authorities tried yesterday to billet 20 children on us, and Miss Buck was able to say we were full." Still, being away from the house made her uneasy. "I wish I could go over and see what is happening," she told him. "I am delighted to have evacuees, as I can do so little to help anybody in my present state. but I would like to be running it myself, and secretly hope they're not pigging up our lovely home."
As cheap as the rent was, the house was expensive to operate. The curtains alone were stated to cost £162, or roughly $10,000 today. Happily, Clementine had agreed to contribute the full cost. Financial pressures mounted.
"Please, darling, pay the telephone account," Pamela wrote to Randolph.
His own spending while in Scotland became a worry as well. He lived and trained with the very wealthy members of his club, Whites, who had formed the commando unit together, and therein lay danger.
"Darling," Pamela wrote, "I know it is difficult. Now you are living with so many rich people, only do try and save a bit on your messing bills, etc. Remember, baby Winston and I are willing to starve for you, but we would prefer not to."
On the evening of Monday, October 14th, 1940, while Churchill was dining with guests in the newly fortified garden rooms at 10 Downing Street, a bomb fell so close to the building that it blew out windows and destroyed the kitchen and a sitting room. Soon after the bombing, Clementine, in a letter to Violet Bonham Carter, wrote, "We have no gas or hot water and are cooking on an oil stove. But as a man called to Winston out of the darkness the other night, it's a grand life if we don't weaken." The same night 10 Downing was struck, bombs also caused major damage to the nearby Treasury building, and a direct hit destroyed the Carlton Club, popular with senior members of Churchill's government, some of whom were present in its dining room when the blast occurred. Harold Nicholson got a full account from one guest, future Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. "They heard the bomb screaming down and ducked instinctively," Nicholson recorded in his diary on October 15th. "There was a loud crash. The main lights went out, and the whole place was filled with the smell of cordite and the dust of rubble. The side lights on the tables remained alight, glimmering murkily in the thick fog which settled down on everything, plastering their hair and eyebrows with thick dust. There were about 120 people in the club when the bomb detonated, but none were seriously hurt."
"An astonishing escape," wrote Nicholson.
With Britain's seat of government seemingly under fire, prudence dictated a fresh retreat to Chequers. Cars and secretaries were marshalled. The usual convoy set off, moving slowly through rubble-strewn streets. A dozen or so miles out, Churchill abruptly asked, "Where is Nelson?" Meaning, of course, the cat. Nelson was not in the car, nor did he appear to be in any of the other vehicles. Churchill ordered his driver to turn around and go back to number 10. There, a secretary cornered the terrified cat and trapped him under a wastebasket. With Nelson safely aboard, the cars resumed their journey. In London that following Saturday night, October 19th, John Colville experienced firsthand the Luftwaffe's apparent new focus on bombing Whitehall. After having dinner at his home, he set out to return to work, riding in a car the army had lately made available to Churchill's staff. Up ahead, the sky was suffused with an orange glow. He directed the driver to turn onto the embankment along the Thames and saw that a warehouse on the far bank was wholly aflame, just beyond County Hall, the immense Edwardian escarpment that housed London's local government. Colville understood at once that the fire would serve as a beacon for the bombers above. His driver headed for Downing Street at high speed. The car entered Whitehall just as a bomb exploded on the Admiralty building which fronted the Horse Guards parade. The driver stopped the car near the entrance to a passage that led to the Treasury building. Colville leapt out and headed toward number 10 on foot. A few moments later, incendiaries began to land all around him. He dropped to the ground and lay flat. The roof of the Foreign Office building caught fire. Two incendiaries fell into the already heavily damaged Treasury building. Others landed on open ground. Colville, heart pounding, raced to number 10 and entered through an emergency exit. He spent the evening in Churchill's reinforced dining room on the basement level. The rest of the night was peaceful, despite an electric fan that sounded to Colville exactly like a German airplane. While Colville was dodging incendiaries in Whitehall, Churchill was at Chequers, in a dispirited mood. He and Pug Ismay sat alone in the Hawtrey room, neither speaking. Ismay often found himself in this role, serving as a quiet presence, ready to offer advice and opinions when asked, or to listen as Churchill tried out ideas and lines for upcoming speeches,
or simply to sit with him in companionable silence. Churchill looked tired and was clearly deep in thought. The Dakar episode weighed on him. When would the French stand and fight? Elsewhere, U-boats were taking a staggering toll in ships and lives, with 8 ships sunk on the previous day alone and 10 more that day. And the continuing cycle of air raid warnings and bombs and the disruption they brought appeared for once to be wearing him down. It was hard for Ismay to see Churchill so tired, but, as he recalled later, a positive outcome also occurred to him. Maybe, at last, just this one night, Churchill would go to bed early, thereby freeing Ismay to do likewise. Instead, Churchill suddenly jumped to his feet. "I believe that I can do it," he said. In an instant, his tiredness seemed dispelled. Lights came on. Bells rang. Secretaries were summoned. Chapter 55. Washington and Berlin. In America, the presidential election turned ugly. Republican strategists persuaded Wilkie that he was being too much the gentleman, that the only way to increase his standing in the polls was to make the war the central issue. He needed to portray Roosevelt as a warmonger and himself as an isolationist. Wilkie assented with reluctance, but plunged in with enthusiasm, waging a campaign designed to spike fear throughout America. If Roosevelt was elected, he warned, the country's young men would be on their way to Europe within 5 months. His poll numbers improved immediately. In the midst of this, on October 29th, just a week before Election Day, Roosevelt presided over a ceremony at which the first lottery number of the new draft was selected. Given America's isolationist bent, it was a risky thing to do, even though Wilkie also endorsed selective service as an important step in improving America's ability to defend itself. In a broadcast that night, Roosevelt chose his words carefully, avoiding altogether conscription and draft, using instead the more neutral, historically resonant term, muster. But otherwise, Wilkie abandoned all restraint. One Republican broadcast aimed at America's mothers said, "When your boy is dying on some battlefield in Europe, or maybe in Martinique, a Vichy French stronghold, and he's crying out, 'Mother, mother, don't blame Franklin D. Roosevelt because he sent your boy to war. Blame yourself because you sent Franklin D. Roosevelt back to the White House.'" Wilkie's sudden strength in the polls prompted Roosevelt to counter with an adamant declaration of his own wish to avoid war. "I have said this before," he told an audience in Boston, "but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." The official Democratic platform added the phrase, "except in case of attack." But now he left it out, an omission surely meant to appeal to isolationist voters. Challenged on this by one of his speechwriters, the president replied testily, "Of course we'll fight if we're attacked. If somebody attacks us, then it isn't a foreign war, is it? Or do they want me to guarantee that our troops will be sent into battle only in the event of another civil war?" The results of Gallup's final presidential trial heat for 1940, conducted October 26th to 31st, and released the day before the election, showed Roosevelt leading Wilkie by only 4 percentage points, down from 12 points earlier in the month. In Berlin, the Luftwaffe prepared to execute a new shift in strategy ordered by its master, Hermann Göring, that would bring an even greater swath of England's civilian population into its bomb sites. A month earlier, after reviewing the Luftwaffe's failure to bring Churchill to heel, Hitler had postponed Operation Sea Lion without setting a future date, though he contemplated revisiting the idea in the spring. He and his commanders had always been uneasy about the prospect of such an assault. Had Göring's beloved Luftwaffe achieved air superiority over the British Isles as promised, invasion might have seemed a more comely prospect, but with the RAF still in control of the air, it would be foolhardy. England's resilience raised a forbidding prospect for Hitler. As long as Churchill stood fast, intervention by the United States on England's behalf seemed increasingly likely. Hitler saw Churchill's destroyer deal as concrete evidence of the growing bond between the two. But he feared worse, that once America entered the war, Roosevelt and Churchill would then seek an alliance with Stalin, who had demonstrated a clear appetite for expansion and was fast strengthening his military forces. Although Germany and Russia had signed the non-aggression pact in 1939, Hitler harbored no illusions that Stalin would honor it. An alliance between England, America, and Russia would create, Hitler said, a very difficult situation for Germany. The solution, as he saw it, was to eliminate Russia from the equation and thereby protect his eastern flank. War with Russia also promised to fulfill his long-time imperative, espoused since the 1920s, to crush Bolshevism and acquire living space, his cherished Lebensraum. His generals were still concerned about the dangers of a two-front war, the avoidance of which had always been a bedrock principle in Hitler's strategic thinking. Now, however, he appeared to cast aside his own misgivings. Compared to a cross-channel invasion of England, war against Russia seemed easy, the kind of campaign at which his forces had thus far demonstrated great proficiency. The worst of the fighting would be over in 6 weeks, he predicted, but he stressed that the attack on Russia must begin soon. The longer he put it off, the more time Stalin would have to bolster his forces. In the meantime, to block Churchill from interfering, he ordered Göring to step up his air campaign. The decisive thing, he said, is the ceaseless continuation of air attacks. He still held out the hope that the Luftwaffe would at last deliver on its promises and by itself drive Churchill to seek peace. Göring fashioned a new plan. He would still hammer London, but would target other urban centres as well, with the intent to annihilate them and, in so doing, crush England's resistance at last. He himself selected the targets and issued the code name for the first attack, Moonlight Sonata, playing off the popular name for a haunting piano work by Beethoven. What he prepared to launch now was a raid that the RAF, in a later report, would describe as a milestone in the history of air warfare. For the first time, the report said, air power was massively applied against a city of small proportions with the object of ensuring its obliteration.